Welcome to Bloomberg View on Bloomberg Radio. Each week, we bring you news, comments, and insights from Bloomberg View's worldwide team of editors and columnists. I'm your host, Pim Fox. This week, we'll explore a rejuvenated partnership between Germany and France. Plus, we'll examine the economic clout of China's senior population. It's the largest in the world. Later on in the program, the future of America's shoe obsession. That's all coming up. But first, the United States signed the Trans-Pacific Partnership TPP trade deal last year, then decided not to implement it. The 11 remaining nations have given themselves until November to decide whether to go ahead. Australian Minister of Trade Stephen Siobo recently said this about the TPP.
We were disappointed, but it wasn't unexpected when the USA withdrew. Obviously, there's been question marks now about what countries might do, but we met recently in Viña del Mar in Chile. We had a conversation, and the 11 of us decided to keep all these options alive.
So will the TPP be successful without the United States? Here to tell us more is Clive Crook, an editor for Bloomberg View. Well, Clive, maybe you can just sort of describe the situation. Do the other remaining nations that have signed on to TPP, do they need the United States to implement this agreement?
Well, there's no question that they'd be better off with the U.S. in the deal. But they don't actually need the U.S. in there to go ahead. If they decide to go ahead, they can. They need to tweak the documents. You know, they need to revise certain aspects of the treaties or simply ignore some aspects of the treaties that refer specifically to the U.S. But it would not be a big task to revise the agreement so that they can go ahead regardless. And some of them, that's exactly what some of them want to do.
Is the agreement beneficial to the nations that have signed on to it?
Yes, it is. I would say even without the U.S., I mean, the bigger the membership of a trade agreement like this, the bigger the benefits, for everyone. You know, it's a sort of mutual advantage kind of arrangement. And the U.S. is the biggest economy by far in the group. And so it's a loss, both to the other members and to the U.S. But even without the U.S., the other 11 can get substantial gains from going ahead. And I think it's clear that's what they ought to do.
What are some of those gains? Does it have to do with tariffs that would be imposed on imported goods? Or what kinds of things would benefit these countries?
Yes, there's tariff reductions. So they would expect to see a significant increase in trade among themselves. And that's important, and that's really like the headline thing in TPP. But there's another aspect to this kind of deal, which is that countries very often agree to do things that are in their own interests, but they find politically challenging to do on their own. And so governments can tell their voters, we're doing this because we'll get these concessions in return from other countries, even though the change they're making would actually make sense if they did it unilaterally. So, for instance, you know, Japan is promising as part of this deal to liberalize aspects of its agricultural markets. That's something that people have been telling Japan to do for years, that it would be good for Japan. But it's politically difficult in Japan. Well, if they go ahead with TPP, they can maintain that momentum for reform that makes sense in other ways. And I think this is true down quite a long list of things that the TPP partners have said they'll do.
The agreement also has what you describe in the piece as a rule book. I'm wondering if you could just explain that and how that could benefit the countries involved.
Well, originally, the TPP was conceived partly as a way to move the multilateral trade agenda forward, given that the conventional method, the time-honored method of doing deals at the World Trade Organization, that's kind of run into the sand. That old-fashioned way of doing these things requires unanimity across a vast number of countries. And it was just proving too slow, and it was getting harder and harder to get deals done. So the TPP countries decided to go ahead and, in effect, you know, design a template for a new generation of trade agreements that goes wider than the old ones, that a smaller group of countries would sign up to initially. But the idea is that this would serve then as an example, and that TPP would be an open arrangement. Other countries could join it if they agreed to meet the standards. And basically, you would go to a more liberal world trading order step by step rather than in one big bang. You know, that was essentially the idea. And I think they succeeded. I mean, I think what they've done, and this was when America was leading the project. I mean, the American trade negotiators deserve a lot of credit for this. You know, they wrote a new and more demanding rule book that brought in issues like labor rights, environmental protection, and embedded them in the trade agreement. This was something the U.S. is very keen to do. And the other countries went along with it. Now, if they go ahead and ratify TPP, just the TPP 11 without the U.S., that rule book will still be there. And other countries can look to it as a model, and TPP itself can grow in future. And in fact, it's not inconceivable to me by any means that a future U.S. administration would decide to join in as it originally intended to.
And the United States almost loses out because it has no leverage not being party to TPP.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd say it's not a question of almost. You know, there's no question, in my mind anyway, that the U.S. loses out. It loses out because it denies itself the benefit to the trade liberalization. It is no longer part of this process of designing the next model for trade liberalization, and it loses leverage in the immediate negotiations it wants to pursue with some of the other TPP members, like Canada and Mexico. I mean, I think it's a big, big mistake. But the other countries can go ahead, and they should go ahead and make the most of it.
I want to thank you very much. Clive Crook, an editor for Bloomberg View, giving us his view on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and how it can succeed even without the United States. At a beer tent rally in Munich following President Donald Trump's visit to NATO's headquarters last week, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said that Germany cannot fully rely on the United States and that continental Europe really must take our fate into our own hands. Well, can France and its new president Emmanuel Macron step in to fill the void that the U.S. is leaving behind? Here to tell us more is Leonid Bershitsky, a columnist for Bloomberg View. Leonid, maybe just lay out the roles that are being played by France and Germany, given that the United Kingdom is working to Brexit itself from the European Union?
Well, after the UK's departure, obviously France and Germany are the two key EU members that are going to be, making policy for the Union. So it's extremely important for Merkel to have a strong partner in France, because Germany has been historically pretty reluctant to take on a leadership role and to visibly act as the country that stands for all of Europe. It's basically because of, Germany's history of trying to lead, not very successfully. That is something that the new Germany doesn't want to do. So it needs almost a point man in France to be effective, and that point man needs to be a strong ally of Germany. So with Macron, Merkel appears to finally have the person that she wants in that role.
All right, so speak now about the role of Angela Merkel and the upcoming German elections and how her relationship with Emmanuel Macron can bleed into domestic politics.
Domestically, stressing that the alliance with the U.S. is not as strong as it used to be is not a particularly strong move for Merkel, because that is basically what the left side of the German political spectrum is saying. The Social Democrats, the Greens, the Die Linke, which is the far-left party, they're all talking about the changed relationship between the U.S. and Germany after Donald Trump's election. Merkel has nothing to gain from siding with them, the sort of the more conservative part of the political spectrum expects her to maintain an alliance with the U.S. because it's very important also historically for West Germany. The U.S. is a country that West Germany has always relied on. So domestically, Merkel didn't really have to say what she said. She was probably sending a message to Macron more than to the domestic voters.
And that message to Macron, was that also a message to Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia?
Actually, yes. I think a stronger Franco-German alliance, the stronger, I mean, than it used to be under President Hollande in France, means a whole lot for the relationship between the EU and Russia. It's the German and French leaders who conduct negotiations with Putin on the situation in Ukraine. You know that the U.S. does not take part in those, and it's up to these two countries to pretty much determine what the Western world wants from Putin. So there will soon be a meeting on Ukraine where Merkel and Macron will, for the first time, sort of play the European negotiating team. This emerging relationship is very important for Putin, because he will need to figure out how to work with this pretty dynamic pair.
What do we know so far about Emmanuel Macron's views of Vladimir Putin and Russia?
Well, Putin has just conducted a visit to France. He met Macron there, and it was a pretty difficult meeting for him, because Macron apparently raised all the uncomfortable, inconvenient issues during the talks, including things like gay rights and, you know, basically human rights in Russia and Ukraine and Syria and all these difficult subjects. And apparently he didn't mince words. Also, he kicked out the Russian propaganda outlets from the final press conference, and Putin had to he had to swallow that. He just stood there and couldn't really object.
So what do you make of the possibility of a fourth term for German Chancellor Angela Merkel, if indeed she does prevail in the elections?
Well, so far, the polls show that she has a comfortable advantage, and she's probably going to win, unless she makes some serious missteps, which is sort of hard to expect of her. You know, her campaigning style has been pretty reliable through three previous elections. So German polls are generally pretty reliable as well. So it looks like she stands a good chance of being reelected.
When and if that happens, she will then have Emmanuel Macron. How will that, as an almost team, work out in terms of what types of things they want to accomplish and how their behavior will match each other?
It's probably a good idea to expect from them some attempt at a closer Eurozone Union. That is something that, you know, both of them want to try doing, but it sort of depends on how well Macron does domestically and whether he's able to achieve anything at home. If his, you know, efforts at reforming the labor market fail, meet with very strong resistance, and he doesn't overcome that, he's going to become as inconsequential as Hollande became, you know, pretty quickly in his presidency.
Is there a chance that France and Germany will be able to fill the void left by the United States in its dealings with Europe?
That is the ambition of Europhiles and, like, European bureaucrats in Brussels. They would like to, you know, see the European Union take on more of a global leadership role and maybe, you know, shunt the U.S. aside a little bit. But whether that's going to happen depends on a lot of things. It depends on how well Macron does in France, how well they work with Merkel as a team, how coherent their agenda is when they finally work it out for the EU and for increasing its global role. But there's certainly potential for that.
I want to thank you very much. Leonid Bershitsky is a columnist for Bloomberg View, giving us his view of Angela Merkel and a new European partnership with France. Nestle, the global consumer products company, recently launched a new product in China called Nestle Yiyang Fuel for Brain Senior Milk Powder. Their target, the 222 million people in China who are currently over the age of 60. It's the world's largest population of seniors, and companies seem to be catching on to the growing economic clout of China's older people. Here to tell us more is Adam Minter, a Bloomberg View columnist and the author of the book Junkyard Planet: Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. Well, Adam, maybe just describe for people exactly the extent to which China's population is older and is aging, and what has brought that about?
Well, as you said, you know, they have 222 million people over the age of 60. And by some estimates, one quarter of the world's elderly will be living in China by 2050. There's a couple of factors that account for this. One is it's a very normal process. As countries develop, their healthcare improves, birth rates drop, and the population gets older. And so China is really going through something that you see happening in Europe and in other parts of developed Asia. The other factor that plays into this, of course, is China's notorious population control policies. You know, there's a lot of debate about how many children didn't come into this world because of China's one-child policy, but it certainly impacted the overall demographics of the country. And as healthcare has improved for the people who are here, it's created an aging population.
Well, having said that, does this then place an undue burden on those that remain in the workforce in order to support the aging population?
It absolutely does. And in fact, you know, one of the unique things about China's aging population and its current sort of aging crisis is that unlike, say, neighboring Japan or Western Europe, China's aging before it grew rich enough to develop institutions, you know, like nursing homes, like a social safety net needed to sustain them. So it's putting a huge burden on society as a whole. And again, you know, we see this in the United States, we see this in Europe, an aging population, fewer workers to support them. It really does start to break down some of the economic bonds and causes tremendous economic stress on a younger generation, but on government as a whole. I should add, too, there's another factor here, and it's a social and cultural factor, and that is China's economic development has really had a profound influence upon the Chinese family. Traditionally, the elderly in a Chinese family stay at home with their children, and the expectation is that children will take care of their parents. But as you have mass economic migration in China, I mean, at any given time, you have 300 million people on the go in China, you know, working in other cities. That has broken that traditional safety net, and it's causing an undue burden on government and in its own way on children, but it's also an opportunity for businesses.
Well, speak a little bit about that. Expand on the idea of how businesses are not shying away from this market. Indeed, they're embracing it.
Well, companies like Nestle, food companies, are starting to look at medicines and products that are not medicine per se, but they extend life. They make sure that, like this brain milk powder, they help maintain a level of health. And that's very much in keeping with traditional Chinese medicine, which is always focused on prevention rather than curing. You can see it in tourism. Whole groups of seniors traveling all over Asia, all over North America. We're talking about between 2013 and 2014, the last time data was taken on this, a 58% increase in the number of Chinese seniors traveling. So that's a huge industry, and people are just now figuring out how to cater to China's senior travelers. And the other area, which is going to have a tremendous influence, will be in housing and retirement homes. As of 2015, China had only 26 nursing beds for every 1,000 seniors. And there's a lot of factors that account for that shortage, dearth of qualified nurses and real estate prices. But whatever the cause, China is going to need to figure out how to get more beds and more care available to its aging society. And so you see a number of innovations happening within this space that will not only have an impact on China, but I would argue will have an influence on how seniors are cared for across Asia and around the world.
And just finally, Adam, what's the government's response been?
Well, the government is, on one hand, you know, they're panicking. They're throwing money at all kinds of programs. You know, China government likes to set up bases, you know, and a base where something will be developed and innovated. So they've set up, for example, 100 bases around the country for smart care for seniors. The idea that you will have automation and smart monitors like Apple Watches on their wrists that can allow the government to collect data instead of having nurses there all the time, put it into a big data AI analyzed databases, and instead of having doctors be the gateway into the medical system, you know, it'll be an algorithm. So that's how the government is really reacting, is they're saying, you know, how do we spend money so that we can actually finance a less human-oriented, human resource-oriented elder care program for China?
Thanks very much. Adam Minter, a Bloomberg View columnist, the author of Junkyard Planet, travels in the billion-dollar trash trade, giving us his view of the aging population in China. America's obsession with shoes will not be portrayed in a remake of Sex and the City. More likely, it will be found in a sneaker store. If current trends continue, men's U.S. shoe sales will soon surpass those of women. And here to tell us more about our obsession is Virginia Postrelle, columnist for Bloomberg View. And Virginia, maybe you could just set out for us the description of what is the shoe obsession as it perhaps is more traditionally thought of for women's shoes.
Well, traditionally, the idea is that women love shoes. This is a media trope. Women love shoes. They see high heels in the store and they think, oh, wow, if I had those shoes, I would be so glamorous, and they buy them. And you know, there's some truth to that. But what, of course, it's not true of all women, but what's been happening, though, in recent years is that both in terms of dollars and number of pairs, men's shoe sales have been going up and women's shoe sales have been going down in the U.S. And the sense is that within a few years, they're going to cross and men's shoe sales will surpass women's.
Why is that? What is there any reason given for why this trend exists?
Yes, there are a few reasons. The big one is that as dress becomes more casual, men and women's shoe buying habits are converging. So that traditionally, guys had fewer pairs of shoes because they got more wear out of each pair. They didn't have as many sitting on the shelves waiting for some special occasion when they might wear them. And even as men's shoe wardrobes have expanded in recent years, that's continued to be true, that men's shoes are just more versatile. They can be worn in more different occasions. Women, meanwhile, have had shoes that could only be worn in certain occasions, and also I think I'm not alone in having a lot of pairs of shoes that I bought. They were comfortable in the shoe department, and the first time I wore them, I said, maybe not so much. So that's something that maybe as we get more casual, women are buying fewer pairs that they don't wear. And then another thing that's happening specifically with women's shoes is that women's shoe shopping has traditionally been very seasonal. You go and buy sandals in the spring, you buy boots in the fall, and women have been buying shoes that they can wear year-round, such as ankle boots or sneakers, and that means they're less likely just to go shoe shopping at all.
Well, I want to bring in something that you describe in your column having to do with sneakers, because sneakers have turned into almost a unisex fashion, and particularly when it comes to sizes. Talk to us about how sneakers have changed the footwear landscape.
Yes, okay. So this is part of the increase in informality. Sneakers can be worn in circumstances where they used to be not appropriate, much more formal occasions. And so people, both men and women, develop sneaker wardrobes, not just one pair or two pairs, but a variety. And there's a problem still for women who love sneakers, which is that although manufacturers have been getting better at it, they tend to limit the number of styles available for women. There's many more styles available for men and even for kids. So that what happens for women who really love sneakers, particularly sort of your sneakerhead types, is to get the styles they want, they have to buy sizes other than women's sizes. So if they have small feet, they go and they buy kids' sizes. If they have big feet, they go and they buy men's sizes. So that some of the quote-unquote men's shoe sales are actually sales to women.
So does that mean that the way in which the fashion industry deals with selling shoes to women is going to change?
Yes. the seasonality issue is a big issue, because retailers have traditionally counted on those seasonal changes to get women to come into the store to buy shoes, and while they're there, maybe buy some other things. And if women are buying less seasonal styles and more year-round styles, then they have to think about marketing their shoes in different ways. One thing, of course, would be to try to offer a broader range of sneakers. But it's not all about sneakers. It's about other types of shoes that are less seasonal as well. But retailers need some sort of shoe merchandise that gives you that sense of transformation. I would really feel cool in these shoes. And men's shoes appeal to that now more than women's increasingly. And that's a huge change.
I want to thank you very much for joining us, Virginia Postrel, a columnist for Bloomberg View. Now, after a series of summit meetings with European leaders at NATO headquarters and the G7 in Sicily, President Donald Trump went on a Twitter tirade about Germany's trade policies. In one of his tweets, he said this: "We have a massive trade deficit with Germany, plus they pay far less than they should on NATO and military. Very bad for U.S. This will change." Here to tell us more is Justin Fox, a columnist for Bloomberg View. Justin, your piece focuses on the trade surplus that Germany has, but you talk about how it is not necessarily because of trade deals. Can you explain?
Right. Yeah, Germany has landed in this situation where they have huge trade surpluses and current account surpluses, which include investment income that they're receiving. And I don't think they really planned this. Now that they have it, they sort of like it, and they get frustrated when people yell at them for having too big a current account surplus. But it's this combination of two things. One was joining the euro, which a lot of Germans were pretty suspicious of. But Germany before the euro always made a big priority of keeping its currency very strong. I mean, the mark constantly rose against the dollar for decades, starting in the 50s. And now in the euro, it's thrown in together with a bunch of countries with weaker economies and lower productivity. And so that keeps the currency down, whereas Germany is as competitive as ever. So that ends up in this situation where they sell a lot more than they take in.
Are bilateral trade deficits, are they bad or are they good, or don't they matter?
They don't really matter. I mean, you can have a really oversimplified version is I have a huge bilateral trade deficit with my grocery store, but that's okay because I get money from other sources and it all sort of goes around in a circle. And I think there are lots of cases in the world where one country will have a huge bilateral imbalance with another, but overall things kind of balance out. I think the issue in the world is these countries like Japan in the past, and to some extent still today, China in the 2000s, much less so today, and Germany over the past decade or so. On the flip side, the U.S. The U.S. runs these chronic current account deficits. These other countries run these big surpluses. Again, it doesn't have to be a bad thing, but it does mean that there's a whole bunch of money going in one direction and goods going in the other direction. And at some point, those goods have to be paid for somehow or other.
Does Germany have any trade deals with the United States?
Not directly, no. It's all through the European Union.
So if it's all through the European Union, supposedly all the members of the European Union would have the same advantages or disadvantages when it comes to trade with the United States.
Correct. I mean, in that sense, in purely tariff-related terms. I just don't think anybody other than maybe Trump thinks that it's trade deals that are the reason for Germany's big surpluses. So I talked about the euro, which is, you know, unless they decide to break up the euro, it's sort of hard for Germany to change that factor. The other one complaint that a lot of other people, including within Germany, make is that Germany, in part, is a reaction to the difficulties it had after reunification in the 90s when it actually ran big current account deficits for about a decade. Did a lot to both cut back on government spending and also keep wages down with a bunch of new labor laws and new labor agreements. And so the complaint there is that Germany needs to, A, pay its workers some more money, and B, be spending some more government money investing in infrastructure, in helping out other struggling Eurozone countries and the like. And then if Germany did that, then the current account deficit would shrink, and it would also help the economies of other countries.
The cost of reunification of East and West Germany, was that considered a sacrifice on the part of the German people?
I mean, it was their choice, and Helmut Kohl chose to do it in a way that didn't make a whole lot of economic sense, but made a lot of political sense, which was to basically accept the East German marks on a one-to-one exchange with German marks, even though in reality they were worth much less. And so that just created this situation of huge competitiveness issues in Eastern Germany and big government spending issues and all sorts of things that just took a long time to work through.
I want to thank you very much for joining us. Justin Fox is a columnist for Bloomberg View. That's it for this edition of Bloomberg View on Bloomberg Radio. You can read more at BloombergView.com and at ViewGo on the terminal. For Bloomberg View on Bloomberg Radio, I'm Pim Fox. Our producer is Samara Lenga. Thank you for listening, and remember to tune into the next edition of Bloomberg View on Bloomberg Radio.